Welcome to TNT, the Technology and Things podcast. Your host, Paul Ferraro, is a former IT exec and currently a technology advisor. Jeff Kruger, a fellow technology enthusiast, is the co-host. They both spent many years working for a Fortune 500 company and are both passionate about leadership, technology, and the community.
All right, Jeffrey, welcome to another edition of Technology and Things.
It is good to be here, Paul.
It's been quite a while since we've been back in the studio together.
I know. I love being in the studio. It's humbling.
It's nice. Yeah. It's nice to have all the gear back and the good sound and everything.
I know. It does make a big difference.
So today we've got Dan Shays of Red Hat coming on our program.
Excellent.
So that's pretty cool. We're going to be talking about automation.
I like that.
You like automation?
Oh, yeah, you know. I mean, we did a lot of automation back in the day.
We did.
What was that joke? It was like I will replace you with a two-line shell script or something like that. There's some old Unix joke like that.
It seems like there's still plenty of automation work to be done.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The automation work never seems to finish.
It's funny because I think when we were big into it, we thought we had automated it all. And like, did we not know anything? You know, like,
no.
It is pretty crazy.
That's what we're going to talk to Dan about, is like, where are people being successful with it? Where's the focus these days? And how are they helping customers? And also hear some customer stories too from... excuse me, we have a...
Do you need some water?
Yeah.
I feel like we learned this lesson before.
This podcast doesn't have water, does it?
No, it does not.
Oh, we've got a cool giveaway for this one.
Oh, I love it when we give stuff away.
We're going to be giving away a Neato robot.
A vacuum cleaning
automated robot.
I see.
We thought it was kind of, you know, fits the theme of automation.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so keep listening and you'll hear how that's going to, you know, how you can enter to win that later on.
Pseudo vacuum my carpet.
Exactly. You did not have permission. You did not have permissions to vacuum the carpet.
Dash capital F.
Yeah.
My carpet, please.
Slash F. I know.
That's awesome. Yeah, I have a couple Neatos. They're very old models, though.
You have a Neato.
They're very Neato. Like, nice. Because, you know, Roomba is the classic vacuum. And it sort of does this sort of circular, just, you know, it kind of feels its way around your room. Where Neato, on the other hand, it like maps your room out like a little scientist. And it figures it out. And then it goes back and forth and like gives you those nice straight patterns on the floor. It looks like someone professionally vacuumed it. Whereas like a lot of times when a Roomba's been through there, it just looks like some drunk guy drove through, you know, on a riding vacuum cleaner or something. So
awesome. Well, I'm glad I chose wisely there.
Oh, you did. It's the premium vacuum cleaner.
Cool.
It also has a very powerful suction on it, I think you'll find.
Good. Well, I can't wait to give that away. All right. Well, let's let Dan in here. I think we've got him on the phone. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
Loud and clear, Dan.
Awesome. How's it going, guys?
It's going well. How about yourself?
Good. Here we go.
Oh, we're going to see you too. Excellent.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's even better.
I overdressed. Now I feel bad.
Oh, because we have t-shirts on?
No, I don't feel bad. I'll get over it.
Don't feel bad. So how are you doing this morning?
As I like to say, I'm staying alive like the Bee Gees. How about you guys?
I like that. No, doing well. Just working on, I think, potentially second or third cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you're really behind.
How many have you had today?
I don't know, but I'm a little jittery, to be honest. Yeah, probably need to eat something. If I tweak out during the podcast, don't mind me.
Right. Same.
Well, Dan, it's great to have you on our Technology and Things podcast. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thank you guys for the invite.
Yeah. So Dan, maybe, you know, to get started, maybe let's just learn a little bit about you first, because we like to know who the heck we're talking to. So
yeah, sure.
Give us some information about yourself.
Cool. I'm a solution architect for our channel team at Red Hat. Been with Red Hat for a little over 7 years. So I've been, came in from the support side, and now I talk too much, so they put me in the solution architecture role.
They were tracking your time on the support ticket calls, and they're like, Dan, you can't talk that much. You need to get that ticket closed and get them off the phone.
Exactly. Prior to that, I worked for a small MSP in Durham, North Carolina, managing small Windows environments and networks and et cetera. And that was kind of my official foray into technology. I guess, you know, prior to that, I did work for a pretty popular for-profit online school, doing IT support for those guys. That's really the beginning of my technical career. I went to school for creative writing, which meant I could wait tables.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I dabbled in carpentry and a little bit in. I was a pastry chef for a while.
Oh, so wow.
I kind of came into this a little bit different, from a different vector than most folks.
Back when I got into IT also, there was a lot of folks that kind of came from that creative side, you know, theater, writing, and all that kind of stuff seemed, you know, was pretty common.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so, it's a much more stable work environment. That's for sure.
It sounds like you're a true Renaissance man. Carpentry, pastry chefing. Yeah. Solutions architecture, it all kind of fits together.
I like messing with stuff, you know, so.
Just don't go flying any kites and thunderstorms, okay?
Noted. Sage advice there.
He's like noted inventor as well.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah. 3 patents.
He's like a Revolutionary War hero. you know.
He does that on the weekend.
Tour in Afghanistan, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I did. Shameless plug. My new passion is motorcycles, and I did ride one from North Carolina to Alaska a few years ago.
Oh wow!
And back down to Denver, but a jack of many trades, master of none, very much fits the description of all you see before you.
Perfect. That sounds great. Well, that sounds like quite a nice career, and I think it probably in your role that you have now, having all that experience of being, you know, in support, in IT, in these different groups, maybe even the pastry chef type of thing helps. But because you get that perspective of actually having lived in those roles before, and when you're talking to customers and other people that are, you know, trying to get things done, you're able to what's it called? Relate.
Yeah, relate.
You can That's relate right. to them. Yeah. yeah.
I'm relating to that.
You've got to source control your cupcakes. I've said it 1,000 times.
I think just for the benefit of our listeners, because sometimes visual things don't translate well in a podcast, you know, you have a great luxurious looking beard there. It conveys the feeling of like a real command of the technical aspects of computing. You know, Paul and I have worked for a long time, and we know that a well-maintained thick beard is a sign of a highly intelligent technologist, you know.
Well, we'll see, won't we?
Yes.
So my first question, Dan, is since we're talking automation, isn't everything already automated? I feel like we've been working on automation for, I don't know, 25 years.
I got some shell scripts, yeah.
And so what's going on?
Or what's different, maybe, too, yeah. right? You know, like.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. We've been automating since we started dropping shell scripts onto the command line and walking away while they executed. And that's that way of automation, while it's technically, you know, it counts, it's still a very brittle way to do it. Doesn't lend itself to flexibility, doesn't lend itself to shareability always. You know, they're typically pretty specialized and unwavering.
Mm-hmm.
And then today we still see a lot of automation baked into, you know, kind of point solutions. I mean, that's fantastic. The ability to do more in less time, that's a huge value add. But I think when we look at, automation today, especially with regard to something like Ansible, it's about really embracing more of a holistic automation strategy. So, you know, I like to use the example of like modern cars today. They've got, you got your navigation, you've got blind spot detectors, you've got backup cameras, you've got all these systems kind of operating and feeding information to a human and saying, you know, make a decision. You've got a turn coming up. And that's great. But what if they were all like, tell it to the car, let the car drive and make decisions by itself. If I'm sitting in traffic, I'd rather answer emails or, you know, read a blog or pay attention to something else with my time.
But you don't already do that? Yeah.
I used to get some of my best emails done on the way home from work.
Yeah, I know. And that was back when you had the T9, right? It was like 333 and I've got a D and then like 555. Yeah.
No. It wasn't good.
Yeah.
That's a good point though, Dan. I didn't think about it that way about the two things you said that sort of resonated with me. One is sort of with the classic automation, it was sort of locked in a box where one admin or maybe a small team kind of knew what that stuff was. And if they left or anything, like all that stuff could just be gone or like it breaks and you're like, I don't know. I don't know where this stuff's at. You don't know what's going on. It's not really centrally managed and it's only working in its own, you know, context.
Did you put comments in your shell script, Paul? Because you need comments. Otherwise, no one will know what's going on with it.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Shell scripts that you can read through in about a second are fine. But when you've opened up that shell script that the senior admin gave to you that he wrote 10 years ago for a Unix box, and he's like, make this work for a new Linux box, and you've filming and just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling, that's extremely daunting.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, is that a good way, a good use of time? Probably not. I think that there's a lot to be said for taking, you know, it's taking a step back and looking at a big picture about how we can get all of those, you know, subsystems talking to each other, all those sensors in the car communicating in a more holistic, unified way. And that's, I think, really going to get us to an order of magnitude beyond where we are today or maybe where we were yesterday.
Yeah. So it's like getting, you mentioned it, some technology kind of comes with its own automation, but trying to hook that into the bigger picture so that holistically you're able to make decisions they're able to kind of work together to make the right decisions. So it's almost like we're never quite really going to be done then, if you will, because as new technology comes out, new ways of doing things, it's like, how do you then adapt the you know, your automation? How do you kind of build upon it? So we're almost like going to be, everybody's really becoming an automation engineer in a way.
Yeah, really. Yeah. You're not actually configuring the thing. You're configuring the automation.
Yeah.
Right. That's to configure the thing.
Yeah.
And the thing should matter less and less as automation itself continues to evolve. Ideally, you know, like we're on the roadmap to say, you know, in the networking space, you know, where previously you would write a playbook or some instructions to automate against a Cisco environment. And now you have to do a separate one for a Juniper environment.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What if it didn't matter? What if it was just like, hey, there's routers out there. You go find out what kind they are and pass them the requisite commands to do the thing I want you to do.
Right. You're teaching it the concepts or the state you want it to be in, not so much concerned about whether it's Cisco or Juniper or Arista or whatever else.
Yep.
Which is,
yep. Yeah, that's the compute with that granularity, not human minds.
Yeah.
Because move on to the next thing.
Yeah, because you're like, I want to forward port 80 to this machine over here. Like, you know, I don't need to know the specific language required to speak to this stack to go do it. And you know, and Paul and I were in IT, you needed to know the specific stack, right? Like, if you were a NetApp engineer, you knew how to, you know, control a NetApp. Or if you were like a Hitachi person, you knew how to like configure Hitachi. But if you think more high level about fundamentally what you're trying to do is say, I want 100 gigabytes and I want it to be available via the following protocols and the following performance profile. And then I don't really need to know how the sausage is made in each of these environments. I'm more focused on the result I want, not the how to make it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Right. The business asks for a sausage sandwich and it's my job to give it to them. So
Right, and you start talking about like what setting. You're like, here's how I got to set up the kitchen and everything. Like, I know. I mean,
when can I have my sandwich?
Want the sandwich.
Exactly.
No, that makes a lot of sense.
A sausage sandwich would be great right now.
That sounds good.
That really does. We need to get that after we're done recording.
So what are you seeing? I mean, you probably you're out in the field a lot, virtually these days. But what are you seeing as sort of the major use cases, or where people are having the biggest the impact for their organizations?
That is an extremely broad question, because the implications of that are vast. I mean, we're seeing automation happening, at the infrastructure level. Like, the easiest way to kind of get in there and get something automated is, your low hanging fruit, if you will, is like start with patching and provisioning. Start with a very simple task, and then iterate on that. So there's a lot of quick and easy wins to be had with, automating the deployment and post-deployment provisioning of systems or environments, and the networking and storage that comes along with that. But in addition to that, there's also we're seeing a lot of activity in the network automation space. That's probably the second biggest area of focus that are conversations that I'm having with folks, because the days of copying configs over to a notepad and making some changes and then copying them back, that's I mean, at first that's kind of dangerous, but also that's there's a better way now. We don't have to.
And I think what you said earlier about, with having so many different types, like if you're talking networking, companies don't have one vendor. They've acquisitions they've made, and they end up with, even if they were like all running Cisco at one point, they're going to have six different vendors, after they've bought five companies, right, or five or six companies. And so that concept of not having to care about every vendor that you have or anything, you can still go through and do all this.
Yeah, every vendor would love for their customers to be a full blown, my stuff shop. but that's just not realistic. Like, heterogeneity exists just organically, like you said, with acquisitions, with outdated refresh dates and whatever.
And competition happens, right? People are like, hey, they're buying this today. And then it's like, oh, they get a better deal from somebody else. And all of a sudden you've got, boom.
That was one of our challenges, like in the, Paul and I did enterprise storage. And, there's a lot of competition in that market. But one of the large hurdles for us being able to implement a new solution to sort of, look for, to jump through a cut under a cost level or something like that was just, hey, like the way you provision it is so different. And our team isn't trained on it. And like, we would have to do all this thinking about training and knowledge and whatever. And it's like, if we were able to be more outcome oriented and say, fundamentally, it's the same thing. I just want the storage. I want it here. And then it enables you sort of to have a more competitive environment where you can have vendor A, vendor B. They can compete on cost. They can compete on functionality or performance. But like, they're not competing on interface, so to speak.
What's the... To maybe take a slight turn, what's sort of the level of difficulty for people to get into working with Ansible? Is it what kind of markup language, or I don't even know if that's the right term, but what's the way that you code this stuff?
Right. Let's see. So the short answer. Well, there's no short answers really. You're talking about the syntax that Ansible uses is called YAML, or the programming language, if you will.
And, yet another markup language.
Right.
Which is actually perfect for the way Paul asked about the question.
Well, it's funny because that was the messaging when we acquired Ansible. Time flies, probably 6 years ago now, 5 years ago. That was the de facto answer. What does YAML stand for? Yet another markup language. and now you go to the BU and they say we don't say that anymore. The new answer is, YAML ain't markup language. they look at it as structured code. And that might just be to the maturing of the product, solution.
Got it.
But the learning curve is extremely, extremely short. You can be, you know, you can go from no skills with YAML to being up and running and fairly dangerous within a few hours. We have workshops that are, you know, use case specific, whether it's server automation, network automation, security automation. And typically we spend, these are hands-on workshops where typically there'll be a hands-on keyboard for, you know, half the time, maybe three quarters of the time with a few slides to explain concepts. And these folks that are attending these workshops are, they're writing playbooks, they're, you know, they're pulling configs, they're making changes, they're doing meaningful tasks against the devices that they're there to learn how to automate. And so learning it is extremely easy. It's very verbose and easy to read so that, you know, a non-technical person can go in and get a sense of what's happening. Maybe not understand it completely, but they'd have a sense. It's not like they're reading, you know, Ruby or C or something like that.
Right, right.
So Dan, I have a pretty extensive computer home lab at my house, and I have learned Ansible over the last 6 months.
Nice.
Oh yeah, we were thinking about you, and I specifically learned. No, I just happened to get into it. But
this is the kind of research we put into this show. Is that we? Yeah. Is Jeffrey will spend 6 months researching and will learn a whole new thing in his home lab for the show.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
It's a testament to the commitment.
Yeah.
Well, and so I was just going to say, I think for me, the hurdle was really understanding the concepts. You know, what's a playbook? What's a, you know, what are roles? How would I use a role? And you know, just understanding the you know, that part of it. The YAML, the actual issuing of commands, is actually pretty simple if you kind of understand what you're doing. You know, it's like, this module, this is the thing you want to affect, and you want it to be present or not present or started or whatever it is. That part's actually pretty easy. But just understanding how does that group hosts together, how does that you know, how does that translate to different environments and things like that. But you know, I think Dan's right. You can learn it fast. Like I've got like maybe a 50 line thing that updates all these different machines in my environment, and I went to Ansible because, you know, I have all these VMs and I was logging in, and some of them are CentOS and some of them are Debian, and you know, I'm going logging into them every week and running the different update commands and like, oh, I got to reboot this one or that one. And you know, it wasn't a ton of different things, but you know, there was a lot of knowledge acquired and it took time. Now I've got a little playbook I run on Sunday mornings that just updates all the packages, restarts any services that are required. It's got some special stuff for, you know, like some of the little services I run, and it just does it all, you know. And if there's a problem, it tells me, and usually there isn't. But yeah, I mean, it's pretty slick. It doesn't really take forever to learn.
Yeah, one of the nice things about, you know, taking that approach over, you know, you could have written a bash script to do some of those things.
Oh, God, that would have been painful.
It would have been painful, but also, you know, it's going to step on, you know, it's going to be a lot more brute force than, you know, leveraging those like idempotent modules where they say, there aren't any updates. If the service doesn't have to be restarted, don't restart it.
Yeah.
Don't bounce my network card if you don't have to, you know, don't, whatever it is. But when you think about that as a home lab and you're like, yeah, it makes my life a lot easier. I get a big part of my Sunday back. But, you know, now think about that with a production environment, and you've got thousands and thousands of nodes that you have to do this with. Like that turns into some real-time savings real quick.
Well, and I wish I had found it a few years ago when I first built the lab, because there are so many things when you're first building it where you're like, oh, I need this special driver installed, or like, oh yeah, there's this little use case where I need to turn off this little feature, or I need to like disable hardware translation in the network card. And so there are so many little tiny things that I did to get my environment working, and I'm like, man, if I ever had to reimage that box, I will never remember all those things. And I wrote them down, but like, where did I write them? I can't remember. So if I was smart, as I was figuring all that out, I would have just coded it all into Ansible. And then if I ever need to rebuild an environment, I just, you know, go rebuild my environment. And all those little things would translate. Because there's a way in Ansible to basically do any of those little things, which is what I think is very cool. You know, there's a module for everything in there.
Yeah, the module support in the community has been fantastic. I always harp on that, because these solutions are, any solution that you're looking at is typically only as robust as the ecosystem around it that's supporting it with those tertiary services. So that extends to, you know, virtualization, that extends to anywhere along the stack. So to see these big software vendors, as well as all of these, all this community support, you know, take us from, I think when we started, we had around 800 modules, and now we've got around over 3,500. And the vendor, like, we had to reorganize how we deploy or how we push out modules, because our vendors were like, you can't get these updates out fast enough.
Wow.
So, you know, just responding to the volume of engagement from the community has been a really profound statement toward, you know, seems like we're doing something right here. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the vendors that are, let me think of my question here. So when these modules are put together, how does that work with the different vendors? Are they, I'm assuming they probably like it because they have access to these modules too. And then they can make sure that, you know, they're talking to their systems the right way and all that. Are the vendors themselves making these modules, or are they coming out of a community, or both?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. Typically, the bulk of Ansible modules are located, or they're so, let me back up. Typically, historically, they've been baked into each Ansible minor release. So when you would download Ansible, all of the modules available for Ansible, with very minor exception, would be included in that package. And we couldn't keep up with that cadence because of the overwhelming interest in creating modules for Ansible. So if you go to like ansible.com and you check out the module index, you'll see all of the modules that at least we know about, including community bits or, modules from like, you know, your Cisco's, your F5's.
Got it.
Et cetera. But because we couldn't keep up with that, we had these vendors saying like, I've got bug fixes waiting and like to get released. Will you please release the next version of Ansible? In addition to the bloat that was causing to the Ansible package, we decoupled all of the modules into more of a repo structure.
Oh, okay.
And so now with an Ansible subscription, you would get access to what's called Ansible Collections. And that's where all of your certified, supported, tested modules live. So if you have a enterprise team that's working with automation, you're going to point them toward the Collections repo. Essentially, it's also located as like in a dashboard, a nice little GUI that you log into through the Red Hat portal, and say, hey, here, like carte blanche, whatever you want to use in here is fine. You don't have to go see, is this supported by Joe in his basement, or is this supported by OEM?
You answered my question. That was kind of, that's what I was trying to understand. So that's where like the subscription based part of Ansible, you that's why you want that, so that you're getting, you know what you're getting, and you have the support behind it, and you've got they've already been tested and et cetera, et cetera.
Yep. All the vetted modules are going to be located there, and a lot of those modules are still available through the community pages. It's just a matter of being very careful to comb through and look through the documentation and make sure that you're not downloading or leveraging something that's not going to be supported. That's not, you know, that could potentially have malicious or unstable code in it, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, and then you guys also have Ansible Tower, right? That's a value added Red Hat product. Right.
Yeah. So the total offering we call platform, Ansible Automation Platform, and that includes Tower, which is that web UI, and it also provides an API interface it's actually extremely comprehensive, on top of Ansible Engine, which is like that command line tool that you can go download for free.
Right.
So those two products are primarily what you would interact with, but in addition to that, you would also get the hosted services like Collections, which I talked about, as well as some analytics, some predictive analytics, and like health metrics on your global cluster deployment. You get a suite of services with a subscription. So yeah, analytics, Collections, and then we recently added a front end similar to it. It's called Services Catalog, but it's essentially a front end that you business users can log into and leverage self-service capabilities with like quota checking and some governance that uses Tower as the backend to launch services and deploy environments and things like that.
No, it's really cool. I think one of the things I wanted to ask was just a little bit about, you know, like the general Red Hat business model seems to be very like closely tied to open source projects where, you know, Red Hat will, kind of glom onto an existing project or acquire a project, or maybe in even some cases, I think you guys have developed open source projects that are, you know, freely available to the community, receive community updates, people get engaged with, and then Red Hat on top of it provides an enterprise level support so that, you know, guys like me and Paul, when we were, you know, working for a Fortune 500 company, you know, the original problem with Linux was you can't run that. There's no enterprise support, right? With Sun Microsystems, you can buy a support contract, you know, and like, yeah. So like Red Hat seems like that's a business model almost really is to take those things and then add on top the bits that a company really needs to be able to rely on this new cutting edge technology that's coming out of or being developed in open source. And just sort of curious, like, what are some of the challenges to that approach or some of the benefits? Like, how do you guys perceive it from the inside?
Yeah, I mean, we have this discussion internally all the time. Because so much innovation happens in open source software, because it's so bleeding edge, you have a lot of businesses that want to adopt those technologies and not wait around for proprietary solutions to catch up. So they're kind of hamstrung between, well, are we more risk averse and we want to wait, or do we want to take on that risk and run potentially unstable, questionable bits in our mission critical environments? And so we sit in kind of that sweet spot where we're taking that, that kind of prototype code and putting it through a suite of, stabilization tests, security tests, doing a lot of hardening and QA. And then getting it to a point where, a lot of these projects are extremely sprawling. And we say, all right, what are the features and subsets of features that our customers care most about in enterprise environments? And let's get this thing kind of pared down to something that we can actually support and then offer that to our business partners and customers. So I like to think of it like consider Uber. Uber is like the car service of the people, right? In this example, let's say that Uber owns all of the cars in its fleet. It doesn't, but let's say it does.
Yeah.
And let's say that Uber says, okay, all of our cars are going to be prototypes. We're using prototypes for the SUVs, for the smaller cars, all of them, they're all prototypes. We're trying new stuff out. And you are relying on this car service to get to work, to put food on your table, et cetera. So these cars break down. They get you to work late. Sometimes the seatbelts don't work. Sometimes the airbags don't go off the cushion. That's kind of terrifying, right?
Yeah.
You're arriving late. You might be banged up a little bit. And your boss is going to be upset with you, right? Because your work is suffering because of it. So is that the car service that you want to use? Or do you want to look at a car service that says, hey, we go to a major manufacturer. We get this end result. That has a warranty. And if it breaks down, like we've got garages and mechanics to come help fix it and get you to work on time. And we actually guarantee that we're going to get you to work on time. And if we don't, like, then that's you can really get honest about that.
That's cool.
You guys basically
that's a pretty close parallel to where we sit in the market.
You're basically taking on all the risk of the open source, bleeding edge, unsupported, right? Right. You're just saying like, yeah, we're going to take that on. And you do it in a methodical way, right? I mean, you don't just, go like, we're gonna take all this risk for you and maybe we'll fail.
No,
like,
the West.
Right, right. Yeah. You have a methodical way of doing that, right? Of structuring it, testing, you add all the things that are sort of would be required in an enterprise environment. Yeah, it's really groovy. It's kind of a neat way of working at it. I kind of wonder sometimes, like, you've got to have people at Red Hat that are mainly contributing to the open source side of things. And then you've got people that are working on your proprietary stuff. And then I wonder if there's like, are there arguments where you're like, is this thing going to be an open source feature or is it going to be a proprietary feature? You know, like, is there a lot of discussion around like what part you're selling and which part you're giving away?
Yeah. Yeah. So the P word is a very bad word at Red Hat. So we don't like to throw it around.
Okay. The P word.
Because all of the, if you look at a project like Fedora, which is very much like that, kind of like that prototype that I described with the Uber car service, and then you look at something like CentOS, that's downstream of all of our improvements, and we commit those back to the community. So I like to call that distinction beyond like us taking, you know, something that's community and then making it proprietary and selling it. It's more about saying, you know, we've taken this solution or this, you know, this widget, and we've changed it in such a way that we think that it's safe now and it's reliable and it's performant. And now we're going to put it over here in this other bucket, and you can use it however you want. But if you need the experts to come and help you with it, which we highly, highly recommend, of course, then we're here, and you can run our branded stuff. So I'm not sure if that answers your question.
It totally does. Yeah, no, it's really cool. I hadn't really thought about a whole lot of it until I was looking at Ansible. I'm like, wow, this is such a, you know, open source thing, but, you know, Rhett, you guys really do own it. I mean, it's not, control its direction and stuff. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it made me think too, back at our previous company, the support that we received from Red Hat was pretty phenomenal. Like when you opened up Sev one type of tickets or whatever, it was pretty incredible. The kind of, because a lot of times with operating systems, as you guys know, it's not the operating system that's having a problem. Maybe it's the hardware. It's something else, and you know, you've got to go do a bunch of other digging to figure out what the problem is. It's not really the, you know. So they did a great job of that.
And they're digging in the wrong place, Cindy.
This isn't the operating system you're looking for.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think part of that too is like I always felt like if I called one of the proprietary OS vendors, like their support line was trying to defend engineering, right? Because they made the product A to Z. Right. It's their product. They sold it to us. We're paying support. And so like a lot of times when you call them, they were like, no, 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 that's not our fault. Or how did you configure whatever? And I always felt like when we called Red Hat, they're like, hey, we didn't invent this stuff, but we do support it. So like,
and we're happy to dig into it.
We are going to dig in there. Like we will figure it out.
It's interesting, different way of looking at it. Yeah. The defense approach of like, hey, you know, these aren't the droids you're looking for.
Right, right.
Just to keep on the analogies there. One more question, Dan. Kind of a little unrelated, I guess, but what are some of the security implications and kind of how do security organizations view Ansible? I mean, are they excited about Ansible or does it make them nervous? What can you talk about in regards to security?
I had one more thing to say about that support experience.
Oh yeah, go ahead. Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome.
No, we answered our own question. Sometimes we do that. We ask one and then we just answer it ourselves. It's like,
go ahead. Yeah.
Forget we have a guest. It doesn't matter. So what, he's an expert.
During my experience in support, it was, and working for other like kind of help desk organizations, it was like one of the most positive experiences I had was hearing from the top down, like, you're going to have customers calling in saying that they did some weird stuff with their community bits on top of our stuff. And it's just a thing that happens because we don't necessarily lock down our products so that they won't do all of the things. We just say, we're going to support this subset of functionality. And if you want to do this other stuff that's in the community, like go for it. We'll help you kind of like figure out where it's breaking, give it your best effort, but we're not going to say like, you did what? All right, I'm going to hang up the phone now. You can't do that.
Right.
So to get that kind of encouragement from on high really meant a lot, you know, to me, as far as like doing right by the customer and saying like, oh, you nullified your entire support contract by downloading these bits and trying to do this thing.
Right.
Because you wanted to see if it would work. Instead, like you've got support engineers going like, this is awesome. You got it to work at all? Oh, man. All right, let's see what we can do about it. And they would do their best to identify, you know, is it the Red Hat part that's falling down or is it this untested part? And if it was identified that it was the untested part, we'd say, you know, here's some ideas on how you could go about fixing it. But like, we're not going to be able to help you much more than this. Like, this isn't something, you know, we've got other folks with their hair on fire. We have to be careful with our time and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, the different
so from a cultural perspective, I thought it was really special.
Yeah. The culture and the philosophy there of like, of helping customers versus trying to figure out how they voided their, you know, their support contract. You know, I think that is a pretty big differentiator. I mean, there are too many people and companies that operate that way, and it's a big pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thank you for allowing me to.
No problem. So yeah,
I think your answer was better to that question than our self answer. So well, I'm glad you asserted.
The listeners will decide that.
Shall we have a poll?
We can do a quick poll.
Whose answer was better?
So
you asked me about security implications with automation. So our security story is still, as far as offering automation to the security teams, right now it's, I would say it's, you know, we're beyond infancy, but I don't think that we're as fully, and this is my solutions architect guide is coming off, and this is real talk with Dan right now.
Excellent. I think that we're, okay, real talk.
we're still working on it. So yes, we do have some baked in functionality with security. We have a security story, but I expect a lot more to come. So like today,
security space is tough. I mean, there's a million products. They don't really talk to each other. We were actually just talking to the chief information security officer of Palo Alto Networks on Wednesday, and we were talking about the thousands of products and all the issues that happen with those. So yeah, I mean, that's right. My question, Dan, wasn't so much that. It was my question was more actually around when you automate infrastructure and networking and these other places, how does security viewing those, like internal security teams viewing that kind of change?
Yeah, because your point of control is now a giant, like you have a central system, right?
Like you could potentially view it as a weakness, or you could view it as a strength that you have this central control.
Right.
I'm just curious what you're, I guess you could look at it both ways, but what are you seeing out there with folks?
Yes. So that's the second part of that question, and I'm glad that you clarified to keep me, again, because I talk a lot.
All good.
So yeah, so first of all, I'm going to say that when you're adopting a technology like holistic automation across your entire team, much like DevOps, that wave that kind of came right before like full-blown, full-scale automation, you've got people, processes, and technology. It's not just, I've got a new tool and now I'm DevOpsing. you have to rethink about how these workflows happen and will happen and really drive collaboration across teams. So when you talk about security, I always say, you know, like all of the requisite parties should be involved, including security. If you're going to be automating against, load balancers, firewalls, anything that might have an impact or raise eyebrows on the InfoSec team, then they need to be included in that early on.
Yep.
So from the people processes part, collaborate, talk more, communicate more, talk about your intentions and your end state and figure out how to get there mutually. The other point that I like to call out from the technology side is, Ansible Engine is great. You can download it right now and you can run it on your laptop. You can test, play with it in your home lab. But don't run community, that prototype example, don't run prototypes in your environment that you rely on your business to run on. Get professional help, get professional help. No.
Seek help.
We know what you mean. Yeah.
My engineers can deploy this without issue. And that's not necessarily the problem. You know, downloading and deploying Ansible is very easy, and that's great. But it doesn't end there. There's a lot of tertiary services that have to be involved and incorporated and integrated. And that all takes experience to do properly and to do safely. So I always say, fully embrace training when you can, whenever you can, fully embrace professional services whenever you can. Someone's done this 10 times, have them do it. Don't have somebody who thinks they can do it. Because sure, that environment could be up and running for 5 years, and that's fantastic. But you might have a blind spot that you don't even know about because you've never done it before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think
the last thing I'll say is, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, finish.
The last thing I'll harp on is agent versus agentless. Anytime you can minimize your attack surface, I think is a good thing. And it just happens that we are agentless. And because of that, that lends itself to that holistic approach where sometimes you can install an agent on a network switch. There's going to be devices that you can't install the required dependencies to run an agent. So agents have their place. They're very helpful. But when you look at security, I think if you have the option to not run one, then don't run one.
Yeah, because the vendor doesn't really want to run a third-party agent on their gear if they don't have to. So like in a way, I mean, and Ansible works with like published APIs and things. So in a way, if you do it right, your automation platform handles the automation part, and you let the vendor's API handle what would be the agent, right? And of course, there's times when you need sort of a more real-time connection or something that an agent would give you. But I think potentially the popularity of platform like Ansible will drive vendors to finding different ways to doing that, because they don't really want you to have the agent anyway, right? So maybe they find
those lines of demarcation.
Right, exactly. So it's like different ways of getting that information, and maybe it's not all for Ansible. It could be for reporting platforms or things like that. But I think we talked about this a lot at our previous employer, like agent versus agentless, and push technology versus pull. In fact, when I started using Ansible, that was my big fear, was because we had a push-based configuration management system, and it's like all you needed was for like one host to be unreachable, and your whole like, oh god, now my 1,000 boxes did not get updated, and we'd go into the weeds. So we felt like we had to have a pull-based model. But man, Ansible really handles it. Like I couldn't even tell you what all the magic is behind the scenes, but it obviously can fire up multiple instances of the work that it's doing if it's working on multiple boxes, and you just start getting results in real time, and it's really very slick how it works, and it's converted me to be like an agentless guy, and like you said, because now like all my boxes need to have is SSH, which they were going to have anyway.
So, that's saying a lot, because Jeffrey does not convert easily.
No.
So Dan, we just have a couple minutes left. What are some good ways for people to get started with Ansible? Like where should they go?
Absolutely. To get started as far as syntax and just learning kind of the components and the nuts and bolts, I usually point folks towards the learning section of Ansible.com. There's a lot of really great, there's webinars, there's labs, there's all kinds of write-ups to do everything you ever wanted to do from a community perspective. Download it, start playing with it. Pick a very, very easy thing and automate it, and then iterate on that. From there, I would say we have a lot of Red Hat user groups across the nation. Just Google search for RUGS, RHUGS, or Red Hat user groups near me, see what pops up.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of a big presence in meetups across the nation. So meetups are, you can search on Ansible or search on Red Hat for those.
I'm assuming those are like virtual these days.
Yes.
Which is kind of cool. In some ways, it's kind of cool for some of this kind of collaboration that maybe you weren't able to get out to your local, microbrewery. You can now just join virtually.
Yeah.
And have your own beer at home. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't have to drive now. I'll also say that we have Red Hat demos. So if you want to get a better sense of the automation platform from Red Hat, you can go over to redhatdemos.com, and we'll have, we do demos there that are public facing. They're open to anyone that wants to join. They're free and they're very engineering centric. There's not going to be much of any of like marketing stuff. It's going to be like, here are the bits. Here's how you do stuff. I'm going to show you a few things, show you where to turn the knobs and flip the switches. So that's also extremely illuminating on kind of finding out where the community bits kind of stop and the value behind a Red Hat subscription kind of picks up.
Nice.
And that's more than just Ansible. We demo all of our solutions over at redhatdemos.com. And then lastly, I'll say engage your friendly neighborhood Red Hat SA. You've got zealots like myself all over the place. So if you've got a really good partner like Evotech, let's sit down and talk about stuff. Let's see how we can work to maybe gain some efficiencies and get automation, the true value of automation realized in your environment.
Absolutely. No, that's great, Dan. And I think my favorite thing out of today was community bits.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm going to take away that and use it elsewhere. So thank you, Dan.
Yeah, go for it.
But yeah, no, thank you, Dan, so much. Really appreciate you coming on and talking to us. This was quite fun, and I actually learned a few things about automation that I didn't know about. So that was cool.
I already knew it all, but you
Jeffrey
know,
didn't learn anything.
It's nice to be validated.
Yeah.
No, you are great, Dan. I mean, really excellent guest. One of the top.
Yeah,
one of the top.
A lot of fun. So when we get back in the real studio, Dan, we'll have you back. We're actually working on finishing up our studio here in the next hopefully 30 to 45 days, and you know, we'll definitely have you out, or we'll come to you.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
awesome. So more on that soon. It. Yeah. Thanks a lot, yeah. Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Have a good one.
See ya. Okay. So that was great, Jeffrey.
It was fantastic.
I just wanted to do one last little plug for our contest. What you're going to do is you're going to go to evotech.com/TNT27.
Mm.
You're going to go there. You're going to enter in the code. What code do you think we should use for the Neato robot?
Is it, this needs to be a secret code?
Yeah, there's a secret code that you would enter, and that's how you would...
Do we get to choose it right now?
Yeah.
It should be community bits. all one word.
I was thinking robot. Just something simple.
All right, well.
But honestly, if you entered community bits, that you'd get extra bonus points for that. I think
that should be worth two entries.
We'll accept either one. But no, go to evotech.com/TNT27, and then you'll have until, let me give you the date, September 25th to enter into that raffle. And then you'll win a really cool Neato robot. So
they're very cool. Yeah. You're gonna want it.
And if you win and you don't want it, just accept it, and then you can send it to me. Yeah,
or me.
Or Jeffrey.
Because I need an upgrade.
Because he needs an upgrade.
my Neatos are old.
Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. Appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the TNT Podcast, Technology and Things, hosted by Paul Ferraro and Jeff Kruger. We'll see you next time.